Hello, I'm Terry McNally. Welcome to KPFK and Free Forum. What are we risking by allowing profit-motivated corporations into the business of war? In the late 20th century, the distinction between soldier and mercenary became blurred. The recent use of private military companies in Iraq has been more extensive than at any time in modern history. And the brutal killing of four PMC, private military company, employees in Fallujah in April 2004 made it clear that these contractors are not merely workers in a foreign land. With over $100 billion in annual revenues and 70,000 employees in Iraq alone, the private military industry is booming, yet few civilians know anything about it. Shadow Company, a feature-length documentary, takes you deep inside this secret world that is changing the face of modern warfare. The filmmakers travel the globe interviewing staff, owners, lobbyists, former mercenaries, academics, journalists, and authors. It explores the moral, the ethical issues private military solutions create for PMC employees, for the Western governments who foot the bill, and for everyday citizens like you. Here in Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Nick Bichanek came to the film and television industry after 8 years of experience in the world of new media. Co-founder of Purpose Films, Nick abandoned PhD studies in chemistry at the University of Cambridge in the late 1990s to found and run a multimedia design and strategy company in London. And after selling the company, Nick returned to fusing his two main interests, storytelling and technology. Prior to Shadow Company, he wrote, directed, and produced Art History, an award-winning dramatic film, and co-produced Under the Cover, a dramatic miniseries for CBC. Welcome, Nick Bichanek, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Hey, Terry, I'm glad to be here. How are you doing?
First of all, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
No, that's actually kind of a funny pronunciation guide I give for English speakers. It's bitch and itch, but take the D off on the and, which makes it bitchinich. It's Croatian originally.
Bitchinich. Okay, Nick. Thank you. I'd like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So what was your path to a film like Shadow Company? And I'm saying, you know, wind it a little bit back of how, you know, you were chemistry, then new media, then a film like this.
Yeah. Well, see, the big thing for me was that whatever I was working in, and I mean, I guess prior to being a filmmaker, I've only really had one career aside from the academic part. You know, the academic part was very interesting. You know, obviously, number of different people around the world go through various incarnations of academia. But when I was studying, I didn't know exactly what I was going to be doing. I sort of had this idea that I wanted to work in advertising because in my naive interpretation of what advertising meant, it was coming up with cool ways to compress stories into short periods of time. However, when the internet exploded, I suddenly realized that there was a very interesting thing going on because the ways in which media was controlled was forever changed. In other words, instead of media being subservient to either a political cause or a financial cause, an ideological cause, it became entirely uncontrolled. And that really appealed to me. And although the things that I was doing in my commercial entity that I was running, the internet company, all the things that I was doing was, like most people, working for clients, so there was always somebody at the end of the day who was pulling the strings. What was interesting for me was the idea that there was loads of people coming up online. In those days, they didn't call them bloggers, although ultimately that's what they call them now. And there was people just who had a voice because it was very easy. The technology was so cheap that though you had so much power as an individual, you could basically be your own publisher or ultimately your own broadcaster. And I liked that idea. That it just really appealed to me that nobody could tell me what to do, that I could go off and do my own thing. So fortunately, when the internet company was sold, I'd always been interested in telling stories in a film medium. And when the internet company was sold, I was able to pursue that passion, again, because the cost of production and the cost of post-production had dropped so significantly that you can basically go and tell any story you like, more or less, in ways in which maybe 5-10 years ago would have been completely impossible, not necessarily impossible, but cost prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
So it so happened that I didn't know that I was going to tell this story. I didn't even know the story existed. I mean, like many of your listeners, I wasn't aware that there was over 30,000-40,000 at the last count private military contractors in Iraq alone, and who knows how many others around the world.
Now, that number, so, by the way, let me see if I'm correct. That number, when you say a number as low as 30, 40, or 50,000, mm-hmm. you're talking yeah. about the ones that are engaged in military activities.
Yes.
You're
I'm
not
sorry,
counting
yes.
an equal or larger number who are over there as private contractors in kitchen logistics, etc.
Yes. Well, we can jump onto that later, but it makes sense to stress the point now. It is exactly like you said. There are my film focuses on a very specific kind of military contractor, and that basically the difference between my contractors, or what I'm calling military contractors, and the other contractors is that the ones discussed in Shadow Company have guns.
Right.
The cooks, the cleaners, the drivers, while they're all a part of the war machine, they're not people who are trigger pullers. And it's the outsourcing of the trigger pullers that I was most fascinated by. Because
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day, the idea of trying to outsource a task that isn't necessarily aggressive or doesn't use weapons doesn't really bother me that much, only because of the fact that it seems like a normal thing. In other words, it seems like something that's happened in many other industries, so why not outsource parts of it in warfare as well? But the idea of outsourcing the guys who actually carry the guns, that's where it starts to get interesting
mm-hmm.
and complicated, and that's why we decided to focus on that particular part. But to go back a little bit to finish off the point, so
yes.
I didn't know I was going to be telling this story. I had a friend who I went to university with who I sort of lost track of, as you do with your college buddies, and his name was James Ashcroft. I knew he went to the British Army. I knew he was there for a number of years because you sort of hear from friends every now and again, and he sent me this email saying, oh, I'm going to be a mercenary, and it was kind of a joke, and I thought it was totally a joke, because my stereotype version of mercenaries was a guy with a knife between his teeth who overthrows foreign governments and all those sort of images that you imagine from watching too many movies. But this guy, James, he had graduated as a lawyer from Oxford University. I knew him from my time in Cambridge, and it just didn't seem to gel that his sort of personality and skill would an education would go with this sort of stereotype. And in fact, he then pointed out to me that I was entirely unaware there was a very large private military industry, and he was simply going to be he was going to do the same thing he was doing for the British Army, but he was going to do it for the private sector. And slowly through him, he was my catalyst to finding out more and more about how these guys work, what they do, who they are. And I was amazed to discover that the rules of war have significantly changed. And, I mean, the U.S. Army can't go to war without private contractors, both the kind that I'm talking about and the kind that you were talking about. They're simply so reliant on the U.S. military industrial machine is so reliant on the private sector that a conflict like Iraq cannot happen without them.
Okay, let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at kpfk.org, also podcast at that same website, kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Nick Bichinich, producer and director of the documentary Shadow Company on the use of military contractors. But it's not just about Iraq. It's kind of the history of it and where they've also played a role elsewhere around the world. You can learn more at shadowcompany.com. And for audios of this and previous shows, you can go to temcnally.livedigital.com. And interviews are also archived for 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archive. Scroll down by date and time. So, I like the fact that this arose for you not out of necessarily a political conviction or a, you know, muckraking sort of thing, but out of this personal friend of yours who suddenly opened a window to you in a world that you didn't even know existed.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
what is one of the things I found fascinating in the film, Nick, is the history of mercenaries. And so if you could briefly give us a little bit of that, I think that'd be helpful.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people are unaware of with regards to the history of mercenaries is that the idea of most people when they think about Iraq and mercenaries, they go, that's weird. I thought we had just had soldiers there. What's going on? Why do we have mercenaries there? But the idea of mercenaries being considered weird in warfare is actually an anomaly. And it's an anomaly that's fairly modern. Only in the last maybe 100, 150 years has that been considered a strange thing. Prior to that, it was fairly common. I mean, not even going back as far as medieval times, but even more recently than that. It's fairly common that if someone chooses a profession of war, they don't just sit there when there's peace. They go off and find a war. So the idea of private actors being involved in warfare, it's considered one of the oldest professions. Of course, it's somewhat ironic that one of the oldest professions is also prostitution. So you can make of that comparison what you will.
Yes.
But the fact does remain that it's only in very recent times that we've had nation-state armies. In fact, one of the fundamental definitions of a nation-state is the idea of a standing army that protects and defines borders.
Mm.
So in many ways, it should be no real surprise that the world is slowly turning towards the privatization of war. In other words, history does have a habit of repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
And quite what that means for the future is, of course, fascinating, because you'd imagine that things like the idea of putting private actors into warfare is something that, irrespective of whether it's happened in the past, we like to think that we should have more control over it. You know, there should be more understanding of exactly what's going on. But the bottom line is that if you outsource certain aspects of warfare, that's not that big a deal. But if you outsource decision-making connected to certain aspects of warfare, that's significantly more serious.
Okay.
That's the thing we're trying to talk about here,
yeah.
Foreign policy by proxy.
Okay. Now, one question that just occurred to me was, it was not in my radar that we used military contractors in Vietnam. Is that correct?
I believe that military contractors were used in Vietnam, but they were in significantly smaller numbers. I have to say that I'm not an expert on the Vietnam War, but I have certainly read a lot about it in conjunction with tracing the history of contractors for Shadow Company. And there were definitely contractors used. They were just in far, far fewer numbers.
Right. While we had 500,000 military in Vietnam, yeah, the numbers were very, very small. Of course, the difference being then we had a draft.
Correct.
How big a part are they playing in Iraq?
Well, a huge part. I'll give some numbers in a second, but let's just consider what happened at the beginning. You know, so at the beginning, there was this talk of the coalition of the willing, but the bottom line was the administration of the United States could not find enough countries to participate in the coalition of the willing. So they created what one of the interviewees in Shadow Company, a guy by the name of Peter Singer, who's an analyst and well-respected analyst at the Brookings Institute, he referred to it as the coalition of the billing.
That's right.
They basically bought allies. The scenario that created is that there simply was not enough U.S. soldiers in Iraq at very early on, and in fact many would argue even now, to fight the kind of fight that was attempted to be fought. You know, you were trying to rebuild the country at the same time as fight an ongoing war, and there just wasn't enough troops to perform that. So there was this surge created for private contractors. The kind of numbers that we're talking about, in Gulf War I, the first time that there was a war fought there, the ratios were there was one military contractor for every 100 soldiers, approximately. In the early days of the second conflict, going back a few years now, the accepted ratios were approximately one contractor for every 10 troops. Now,
it's closer to one for two, isn't it?
Well, now it's gone to one for two, one for three. I was just saying at the beginning of the most recent conflict, it was 1 in 10.
Yeah.
Now it's 1 in 2, 1 in 3.
Right.
It's absolutely amazing. Now, of course, one of the most amazing things about that is that we don't know exactly what these ratios are. As Congresswoman Schakowsky has stated when we did a Washington, D.C. screening and a Capitol Hill screening of Shadow Company, she pointed out that she's asked Congress repeatedly to find out how many military contractors are operating in Iraq. And the answer is that no one knows exactly. Everybody knows it's a very large number, but it's amazing that you can't even put your finger down on something like that. And these things should not be that difficult.
That's right. Well, I mean, if we have this much of the kind of conversation, dialogue, conflict, and so on that we've had over adding 21,000 troops in what's called a surge, the fact is that somewhere along the line, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 contractors were added, and no one even knew about it.
But you see, it's kind of convenient, if you can imagine, because when contractors die, you don't have these these are not these don't come back as casualties in body bags with flag draped coffins. it's sort of swept under the carpet. It's sort of like it's not just an unforeseen cost of the war as far as dollars, but it's also an invisible cost of the war as far as deaths. And these are not insignificant numbers. I mean, quite a number of contractors have lost their lives during the course of the war, not just military contractors, but the other non-military kinds.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what that number is?
Unfortunately, my number's a little bit old. I have an idea of the number of military contractors, and the number was at 205 as at June 2005, I believe. And now if people want accurate numbers, there's a very good website called iCasualties.org, and it tracks numbers of deaths of contractors in Iraq, both the military kind and the non-military kind.
And that's one word, I. Casualties.
Just the letter I.
And then casualties.org. Very good. Okay. And are they also fighting in Afghanistan?
There are a number of contractors in Afghanistan. Now, just to clarify the word fighting, you see, the private military industry is very quick to stipulate that their employees are involved in defensive operations, that they're essentially a form of a glorified security guard. Now, in principle, this is true. The mission profiles for private contractors that are armed in Iraq are of a defensive nature. They are defending individuals, they are protecting convoys, they are protecting locations. But they are definitely part of the military force. They present an aggressive image. They are indistinguishable in terms of the equipment that they use and the manner in which they move, and in fact their skill sets from regular soldiers. And in point of fact, the insurgents perceive them as legitimate targets in the same way they would regular soldiers. They don't really distinguish between them. So even though the industry takes great pains to point out that they are technically only performing defensive tasks, I don't really see this as a gray area at all. I see it as exactly the same thing. They're effectively part of the military presence there.
Let me ask you a quick question. Rules of engagement, do they differ?
They do differ because the rules of engagement for military contractors are quite tightly outlined. Let's give you one simple example. You're driving in a vehicle and you're protecting a particular individual. Let's say he's some sort of a manager for a reconstruction project, because bear in mind, these guys are generally protecting things connected to the reconstruction in Iraq. So they're protecting this particular individual and a vehicle is coming up towards you at high speed and you don't recognize the vehicle. What do? You know, you're a guy, you're the rear gunner, you're pointing towards the back of the vehicle, you're driving away, and you know that you're supposed to be protecting against suicide bombers, you're supposed to be protecting against people who might be coming up to try and assassinate your client, to try and kill you. So you've got a split second to make a decision, but you do have a certain set of rules that you follow. You're supposed to indicate by holding up your fist to the vehicle to stop. There's a cease and desist area of about 100 yards, and if the person encroaches that area, you can signal to him to stop. If he does not stop, you are then allowed to fire into the road in front of him. If he continues to come towards you, you are then allowed to fire into the vehicle. And if he still continues to come towards you, you're then allowed to kill him. Now, that all sounds well and good, but the problem is, this scenario that I just outlined, and I took 30 seconds to tell the story...
Happens within two or three?
Exactly. Yeah. It happens in about 2 or 3 seconds. So you've got essentially the responsibility for whether to shoot or not shoot and whether to analyze the threat rests in the hand and in the experience of the person who's holding that machine gun in the back of a truck. Now, the majority of the people who are in those positions are extremely experienced soldiers, and they're quite used to making those kinds of split-second decisions. And by and large, on the basis of the people that I've spoken to, they are more than capable of making them and making them correctly. The sad fact is, think about it, we don't know how many people there are there. We don't know exactly who all those people are.
Right.
And people slip through the cracks. And this is a little known, sort of an open secret, if you wish, in the private military industry, that there are cowboys. And we know there are cowboys, and the more respectable companies are keen to get those cowboys out of there because they know they give everybody a bad name.
And by a cowboy, we mean someone who is in there not just for the money, which is the one of the reasons to be in there, but to be in there because they like the danger, they like the gun, they would like to find a place to play at violence somewhere in the world. It may be unconscious, it may be conscious. That's the kind of person you're talking about, right?
There's a lot of the guys. You're describing a slightly bigger group than I was referring to with the cowboys, because a lot of the guys. Well, I asked, as you can imagine, I was trying to figure out who these guys were, what they did, and why. And I asked a lot of them the question, you know, why do you do this? What drives you? And for sure, for a lot of these guys, the answer is money. But it's rarely only money. And obviously the answer is money because when you've got 15, 20 years experience as a special forces operative, where else are you going to use that skill set?
Exactly.
You're not going to go and be a manager in some factory in the middle of nowhere because you'll bore yourself to pieces. So instead, you take a job like this. So in a way, it's totally understandable that when you have this skill set, you've got bills to pay, kids to put through school, you're going to go and chase the money like everybody else does. However, all of them are adrenaline junkies of one sort or another. Otherwise, it would be very tough to justify the risks that they put themselves through.
Okay, let me tell people, Nick, that you're listening to Free Forum, KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, speaking with Nick Bichinich, producer and director of the documentary Shadow Company on the use of military contractors, especially in Iraq. You can learn more at shadowcompany.com. That's one word, shadowcompany.com. Audios of this and previous shows you can find at temcnally.livedigital.com. Interviews are also archived at kpfk.org for 90 days. Go to audio archive, scroll down by date and time, and my show and many others on KPFK are podcast as well. Go to kpfk.org, and there's a link there, and you can actually subscribe to my show and hear it whenever you wish. Let me tell people, upcoming on Free Forum, well, upcoming, first of all, let me tell you that at the LA Times Book Festival, Saturday, 4/28, I will be broadcasting live, as I have for the past few years, from 3 to 4 p.m., and that is always quite interesting because we usually have 2 to 3 really exciting authors at once. That night also Greg Pallas, this is the 28th, will be speaking at a KPFK fundraiser at the Emmanuel Presbyterian in Wilshire near Vermont. So that's April 28th, Greg Pallas in L.A. On the 15th of May, I will have Paul Hawken, author of The Ecology of Commerce, speaking about his newest book, Blessed Unrest, about the huge global movement for social justice and environmental justice. Let me go back then to Nick. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
What are the biggest risks you see in the use of military contractors? And if you could, in the middle of that, say what the law is regarding, what controls them?
The biggest risks, in my opinion, with regards to using private military contractors, is losing track and control of what's going on. I don't personally see an inherent problem with the outsourcing of various aspects of military force. However, I see a massive problem with the idea of outsourcing foreign policy. Foreign policy by proxy. I mean, there's a system of checks and balances in place in basically global governance, and especially in the United States, which means that the president can't just go and decide to go to war without certain criteria being satisfied. If we try and push the ability of fighting into the private sector, we are bypassing those checks and balances, and that's an extremely dangerous environment, and one that I think both sides of the political fence will ultimately decide is a bad position to be in.
Now, let me see. It seems to me that's in a very strict way, but as you referred yourself to earlier, there's another way in which let's say that the numbers right now are close to 1-to-1.
Yes.
So if America, the people, the Congress, the administration think that they're talking about 100,000 troops, 120 or 130,000 troops, when in fact they're also talking about this other 100,000, that they're kind of aren't on paper. So that the cost of what we're doing, and both financially and in lives, is invisible. And that actually is a missing ingredient in the decision-making, isn't it?
I completely agree. I mean, that's why when you hear people say stuff like, get our boys home by 2008, and you see all these people coming out and supporting that, well, it's a bit of a misnomer, because it's all well and good the troop numbers decreasing by 2008, theoretically. But if those guys are simply resigning and flipping around and going to work for private military companies, but you don't hear about it, what have you really gained? And this is one of the reasons why films like Shadow Company and a number of other books that have come out on the subject are vital, because it just brings this issue to light.
Yeah, very quickly, Nick, I want to interrupt you for a sec, but there are two new books out. Robert Young Pelton has a book called License to Kill, and Jeremy Scaha has one called Blackwater. For people who want to learn more about the subject, besides DVD of Shadow Company, what's the take on these two books?
Robert Young Pelton's book, well, Robert is one of the interviewees in Shadow Company, and his book is a very balanced look at exactly how the private military industry works and where it got started, and some indications as to what Robert's opinion is on the basis of talking to a lot of people as to where it's going in the future.
And my guess is his is a big picture.
His is a big picture, yeah.
And, now, and Jeremy Scahill's Blackwater?
Jeremy analyzes a specific and fairly infamous private military company. Blackwater was the employer of the four men in Fallujah who were killed and mutilated, and the bodies were hung from a bridge. A lot of people are familiar with that image. Jeremy's view of Blackwater is very well researched. However, he wears his political heart on his sleeve. So it's fairly clear as to what the agenda of the book is, although it's a very interesting read, and it certainly looks in depth at one particular company and what Jeremy feels is the connections between that company and the current U.S. administration.
Okay. We're going to wrap up in basically a minute and a half. What do you think listeners should learn and do if this issue matters to them?
The biggest thing that I think people should do, and I can tell this is how it generally works, and people are enthusiastic about this when I've screened this film in various places and when you have the big discussions afterwards, is to educate yourself. Because, you see, truth has a nasty habit of not taking political sides. So to approach an agenda that's as thorny as privatization of warfare from an extremely partisan standpoint doesn't do any good to basically understanding it, because you're essentially going to go either, oh my God, these guys are great, or you're going to go, this is evil, let's stop it. And the truth, as it usually is somewhere in between. So watch the movie, get the books, read as much information as possible, and I encourage everybody to basically make up their own mind about what they feel about the problem.
And as we talk so often in this thing, is because it seems to be so much under the radar, educate others as well, because this is something where once you know, you'll be one of the few who knows.
For sure, yeah. I mean, as you mentioned before, shadowcompany.com is the film's website. It's where you can get the DVD. Now, bear in mind, the DVD doesn't just have the movie. It has about 3 hours of additional footage, including lots of full-length commentaries, and the entire question and answer discussion panel, including Congresswoman Schakowsky from the Washington, D.C. screening.
Very good. So, again, the website is shadowcompany.com. Thank you to G, my engineer, to Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, email me at T.E. McNally. That's one word, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at att.net. If you want to comment or ask questions, if you'd like CDs, tapes, or transcripts of previous interviews, or if you want to receive my weekly email announcement of who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. And for the audios of this and previous shows, temcnally.livedigital.com. And this program will be archived for 90 days at kpfk.org. You can also go to kpfk.org to register for podcast, and you can receive this show when and where you want it yourself. Thank you, Nick Bichinich. The film is, and the website are Shadow Company. Keep up the good work.
Thanks very much, Terry.
You've been listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live at kpfk.org. Stay tuned for the KPFK Midday News up next.
KPFK is pleased to present BBC investigative journalist Greg Pallast for an insightful and entertaining evening Saturday, April 28th at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, 3300 Wilshire Boulevard near Vermont. Greg Pallast is on a 10-city tour with newly released copies of his paperback version of Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. Copies of the book will be available. Pallas will address class warfare post-Katrina, sharing clips from his DVD, Big Easy, Big Empty. He'll also focus on other topics raised in Armed Madhouse. General admission is a donation at the door, no reservation is necessary, and no one will be turned away for lack of funds. Children under 12 accompanied by an adult will be admitted free. KPFK looks forward to a stimulating event on behalf of the station with the